for the year. Kind of a strange place to have a meeting in January. We started with snow on the ground and left with ice on the ground. But they say that's a good time for them for meetings. We had a number of visitors in spite of the weather, but that's when they have their meetings, is in January. But anyway, had trouble getting home, but made it home, and I'm glad to be back with you. They have two good elders there. It's a good solid church, a very strong church. Donis Bailey is the preacher, very strong, solid man, and I appreciate the work that they're doing there. It was good to be with them and good to be back here with you. The lesson that I'm going to present this morning is one that they had asked me to present there, and while it's fresh on my mind, I thought this would be a good occasion to present it here. But I want to say a little history, just a little bit, because you are familiar with the material that we're going to be talking about. Back in the mid-90s, the four elders that we had then, of which I was not one, in fact, three of the current elders were not of that eldership, they asked me to preach on modesty. Those four elders did back in the mid-90s here. And I did. And the next year, those four elders came to me and said, we want that same lesson, not a similar one, but that very same lesson again. And the following year, they said, we want that very same lesson again. And the following year, they said, we want that very same lesson again. And you get the picture. A little later, I decided I might rework that a little bit and make some fresh approach to that, but it's the same point, same material, and I have. And I've been repeatedly asked in meetings to address the material, on not because of my presentation of the material, but because of the need for that material. And so today I want to talk about sexually attractive dress. You've heard the material before. I speak, I think, for all four of the current elders, of which I am one, that we all four believe that there is a need for repeated instruction on the subject. Not necessarily that it has to be every year, but I think we all would agree that every year is not too often to have some instruction on the subject. That title, Sexually Attractive Dress, has been carefully crafted and worded. That's not a catchy title. It is carefully worded to describe the problem that we're talking about. And the reason is as follows. Perhaps the term modesty or immodesty sends a different message to different people. And that concept may give the impression to one that things are okay when maybe they're not okay. And thus, one who dresses in a sexually attractive manner, whether they know it or not, may think she's not immodest. Thus we talk about sexually attractive dress. I want us to begin with the concept that it is possible to dress in a way so as to be sexually attractive. You might open your Bible to Proverbs 7 and in verse 10. We'll come back to this later in our study. But Proverbs chapter 7 and in verse 10 talks about the attire of a harlot. The attire of a harlot says something. That is, she dresses so as to sell her product. The Living Bible Paraphrase translates that she dressed seductively. That's sexually attractive dress. Being sexually attracted or attractive is not wrong. In fact, Proverbs 5 talks about rather than seeking this intimate relationship with a harlot, you're to seek that intimate relationship with your wife and being attracted and attractive to the husband and wife. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 9 said it is better to marry than to burn with desire. They're talking about being sexually attractive. In fact, God made us that way, to be sexually attracted to one another. But being sexually attractive or attracted to anyone other than our marriage partner is wrong. And that's what we're going to see in our study. I'm going to ask you, as I've always asked, to give this study and any study a fair hearing. Such studies as this does more good than we credit them. I recently made a statement in the pulpit about this subject that I wonder at times, and we get discouraged, does it do any good? And several of you came to me and said, it does do good. It does good for my family. Keep preaching it. We want to hear it. We want our children to hear that. It is doing more good than we credit at times. Evidence, it would be much worse if we didn't talk on the subject. And that's why the elders years ago would say again and again and again, we want to hear that. And that's why the current eldership says we need a diet of that. It would be much worse if we didn't teach on it. In fact, it is much worse in some places than it is among us. I will recognize that not everybody is going to accept this material 100%. And also recognize that not all who would come out and say, I agree with you 100%, everything you said I fully agree with, amen, keep preaching. Not all of those people will conform to the principles with which they say they agree. So here's what I'm asking you to do today. I'm asking you, and some of you will be hearing this material for the first time, and that is I beg you to give it a fair and an honest hearing. And all I simply ask is that you give it a fair hearing and weigh it out in light of the scriptures, and then think about your own application of that. I'm going to speak plainly and bluntly, and yet at the same time, hopefully tactfully. When we talk about sexually attractive dress, we have to talk about things that are delicate in their nature. And so we'll talk about that. We're going to be blunt. We're going to be plain. And at times it may be offensive to some. I recognize that. But I ask you to give it a fair hearing. Here's some beginning considerations, as I call them. Let's understand at the beginning, and I think most everyone would agree with this, that is, the Bible sets guidelines about our dress. And if that's not the case, if you would say, no, the Bible doesn't set any guidelines for dress, the Bible doesn't say anything about how we dress, then we can dress or undress in any fashion we wish and be acceptable unto God. I don't think anyone present this morning would agree with that. If the Bible sets guidelines for dress, then a violation of those guidelines, whatever they be, would be sin. And if the Bible sets guidelines for dress, that means the Bible becomes our standard, and the world is not our standard, nor are the parents our standard, or the preacher, or the elders, or what I've always thought, or what I've always done. Meaning by that, it would be easy, and it is easy for some to pass this material off and saying, you know what, I just don't agree with that. And when I talk to denominationalists, you know, when I talk about baptism, you know what they say? I don't agree with that. But there's more responsibility than to say I don't agree with that. The world is not your standard, nor are the parents the standard, but the Word of God becomes our standard. I begin with this assumption, and that is that you want to dress in harmony with the Bible. And some would be quick to say, no, I think we have some that are not don't want to dress in harmony with the Bible. That's not my point. I'm assuming that you want to dress in harmony with the Bible, and I would assume that how you dress you think is in harmony with the Bible. I doubt there'd be anyone present if we were asking for a show of hands and you were to be so bold that, you know, I know I'm dressing out of disarray with the Bible and I know I'm sinning, but I don't care. I doubt anybody would say that. Not a person present would. And if that is your desire, that I want to dress in harmony with the Bible, I encourage you to listen and pay attention, because James 1 says we're to receive with meekness engrafted word which is able to save our souls. If that's not the case, you say, I don't want to dress in harmony with the Bible, I don't care about that, then you haven't rejected this lesson, you've rejected God Himself. And that's a very serious matter according to John 12. We must admit this, that a great portion of today's clothing is sexually attractive. A sampling of that are things that may be true among some of our members here, may be true of people that you know are people of the world, but they're low-cut tops, they're short shorts, there's tight jeans, form-fitting clothes, short skirts, dresses with splits in them, wording across the backside or the rear, which draw attention to that portion of the body. And what that does is that draws attention to the female body. Evidence of that? Let's go back a little bit. Let's go back a number of years ago. Back when I was a teenager, or even before, when the miniskirt became popular, Mary Quant, who was the designer of the miniskirt, here's what she said, mini clothes, M-I-N-I clothes, are symbolic of those women who want to seduce a man. Now maybe every woman that wore that wasn't her concept, that was the designer's concept. She said this is what they were designed for, to seduce a man. Where is this all of this headed? She said in one word, sex. This is not a new problem. Let's go back a few years. Let's go back to Life magazine, 1956. That was before I was born. Life magazine reported that short shorts were favored to Bermuda shorts because Bermuda shorts emphasized the least attractive part of the leg, the knee and the calf. Which means short shorts, do I have to be specific, emphasize the more attractive part? We must admit that a great portion is sexually attractive in our dress. Now, our culture thinks that's good. This is not a new problem. Isaiah 5 talks about those who call evil good and good evil. That's not a surprising thing. Philippians 3 talks about those whose glory is their shame. That is, they glory in that which they should be ashamed of. Evidence? Someone dresses in a sexually attractive manner. Maybe it's a low-cut top or a short dress. And someone, maybe a fellow Christian, will say, "You look darling in that dress. That's you. That's your color. That's your dress. That is your outfit. You look astonishing in that." They just called evil good. We would be naive to think that our culture does not rub off on us. That if our culture is calling evil good and much of what goes on in society is involving itself in a sexually attractive dress, we would be naive to think that doesn't have an impact upon us. Now let's list some reasons why people dress in a sexually attractive way. Number one, some dress that way because they're ignorant and untaught. That's not a reflection upon their intelligence. They may be very intelligent people, very, very intelligent. But on this subject, they're ignorant of the scriptures and they just haven't been taught. So sometimes people are dressing in a way that is inappropriate because they haven't studied the scriptures. It has dawned on us sometimes as elders that when somebody would be dressing in an ungodly manner, we may talk about that and say, "You know what? I don't think they were here or they were present when these subjects were taught." And so we try to see that they are taught. Some dress that way simply because they want to fit in. They want to fit in society. They don't want to be out of step with society. This is what everybody else does. Everybody else wears these kind of outfits, so therefore it's acceptable. Some do this because they want to fit in and turn heads. Just recently I was asked to speak on this in a congregation where the elders told me that they had a lady there that admitted that the reason I dress this way is I want the men to look at me, and the man, the husband, said, "Yes, I want men to look at her and see what I have got. I want them to see my trophy," in other words. Turning heads. Some dress this way because they're careless. And they don't stop and think about three principles. Number one, about divine principles. That is, when putting an outfit on, they think about whether it looks good, does the color go, but they're not thinking about divine principles come to play, number one. Number two, am I allowing the world standards to influence me? And thirdly, how we're gradually drifting and getting looser. And furthermore, some dress that way because they don't know how they really look. Meaning by that, they think they look good, they think they're covered, and they don't realize what's happening maybe when they stoop, when they bend. We'll get to that a few minutes later in our study. Now, the first three of those are probably not true concerning much of the crowd here, but I suppose that when we have problems, it probably falls into the two latter categories. And that is, we become careless and we're just not thinking about divine principles. How does that play? And we don't realize how we look to others. And so I bid you give it careful attention. Let's start with this. Here's our first point. Let's talk about some simple principles for dress. And let's start back with Genesis 3. I encourage you to go back to Genesis 3. I want to talk about divinely made clothing. Divinely made clothing. I think you would agree with me that when we talk about things that are made, something divinely made is far better than something that's man-made. Because God knows what He's doing. And I want to see in Genesis 3, man made some things, and God made some things, and God did a better job of making things. And they both tried to make some clothes. Let's open our Bibles to Genesis 2 and 3. If you are not already there, let's go there to Genesis 2 and 3. And I want you to notice, as we're introduced in Genesis 3 and in verse 7, God had made Adam and Eve. And let's back up to chapter 2 and verse 25. They were both naked and they were not ashamed. If you're so disposed to make notes in the margin of your Bible, you might write out to the side, "They were nude, without any stitch of clothing." That's the way God made man. That's how you were born, by the way. I said we'd be blunt, but that's Bible terms, and that's the condition they're in. But let's go a little bit further. They're naked. Well, let's come to verse 7. That's the condition they were in. When they ate of the fruit, they now realized that they were both naked. You might underline naked and write out to the side, nude. They're still nude. So at verse 7, they made for themselves out of fig leaves. They took for themselves and sewed fig leaves together and made for themselves coverings. Your translation may say apron. And so they made themselves an apron. What was an apron? Well, this apron was a girdle-like loincloth type of garment that covered the midsection of the body. Where do I get that idea? Well, William Gesenius, the Hebrew Lexicon of the Old Testament, Kyle and Datelage, H.B. Leupold, Brown, Driver, and Briggs. Two of those are lexicons which define Hebrew words. The others agree with that, which were Old Testament Hebrew scholars. They agree with the principle that it was a girdle-like loincloth type of garment. If you have a marginal note, you might trace your marginal note at verse 7, and it'll say girding coverings, meaning it was a girdle-like type of garment that covered the midsection of the body. So that's man's attempt to cover himself. But I want you to notice at verse 10 now, before we come down a little bit later, verse 10 says, after they have covered themselves, the text says, I was afraid because I was naked. Might underline that. And might out to the side. They're not nude now, but still naked. After they've covered the midsection of the body, they're still said to be naked. Not nude, they've covered, but still said to be naked. Now let's come down to verse 21. Here's the divinely made clothing. God saw fit to clothe them, and also for Adam and his wife, the Lord made tunics of skin and clothed them. If you're making marginal notes, I want you to notice that they're not covered until now. And furthermore, God put clothes on the man and the woman. He didn't clothe her and said it didn't matter about him. You dress how you wish. I'm not interested in clothing you. He put clothes on the man and the woman. He made clothing for both of them, the text says. But he made them tunics of skin. A tunic would cover from the shoulder to the knee by definition. Let's get the evidence of that. This is the ISBE article on dress. And it said the chiton resembled the Roman tunic, corresponding almost nearly to our long shirt, reaching to the knee always. And in case of dress, it was for dress occasions, reaching almost to the ground. Later in the article, it noted that the chiton was of the peasantry was shorter than like the modern chemis of Syrian fellah, which is to the knee. ISBE says that this word that is translated dress or is translated tunic always came to the knee. Sometimes it went much longer than that. Gesenius, we talked about him a moment ago, quotes Harris and Brown, Driver, and Briggs. Again, we have three lexicons that define it, and here's basically what they say. That the word generally had reference to something with sleeves, coming to the knees and rarely to the ankles. It covered from the shoulder to the knees. Fred Wright, in Manners and Customs of the Bible Times, said this. He said, the tunic in properly translated coat was a shirt which was worn next to the skin. It was made of leather, wool, hair cloth, wool, linen, and in modern times usually of cotton. The simplest form was without sleeves and reached to the knees and sometimes to the ankles. The well-to-do wore it with sleeves extending to the ankles. Women as well as men wore it, although there was no doubt a difference in the style and the pattern worn by the two. The point is, every one of the authorities agreed that a tunic, by definition, covered from the shoulders to the knees. You say, well, we're not governed by Genesis 3. All right, I'll give you that. But I want you to notice that when God clothed man, they were nude, then they were still naked, and it wasn't until they were covered by God from the shoulder to the knee that they were covered and their nakedness was covered. Not until that point. Now that principle of what a tunic is going to harmonize with other biblical principles. And we're going to see that as the lesson unfolds. Secondly, let's talk about nakedness. That is a Bible term. Nakedness is not to be seen by others except by our mate. In the Old Testament, nakedness, seeing the nakedness of another, uncovering the nakedness of another was prohibited. We won't take the time to read Leviticus 18. But Leviticus 18, 6 and 7 simply made the point that you're not to uncover the nakedness of your father nor the nakedness of your mother. What that implies is that the normal state of things is for nakedness to be covered. If this were a Bible class and I were to ask you individually, do you think nakedness ought to be covered? I doubt anyone would say, I think nakedness ought to be shown. But I think we would all agree nakedness ought to be covered. That's what this passage implies. Showing nakedness was always equated with shame. It was in Genesis 3. I was naked and I was ashamed. Why was he ashamed? Because of his nakedness. Throughout Revelation, there is an equating of nakedness with shame. Revelation chapter 3, 17, 16 and 15, and 17 in verse 16, just as a sampling of that. Now, let's talk about nakedness. The word in the New Testament that is translated nakedness can mean complete nudity. It can also mean partial nudity that harmonizes with the Hebrew over in the book of Genesis chapter 3. Let's see. Thayer says this, that it can mean unclad and without clothing. Oh, we all recognize that. We don't have to prove that. But sometimes the word naked can mean, according to that same authority, Thayer, ill-clad or clad in undergarment only. By the way, undergarments covered much more than our undergarments do generally. More like we would think of as long johns. Was still said at times to be naked. Badly clad, not fully clothed, Kittle says. Liddell and Scott says lightly clad. The point is that one can have some clothes on and still said to be naked. You would probably be offended if one of the elders walked up to you or one of the sisters walked up to you and said, you know what, you need to go home and cover your nakedness. You're naked in here. And you get offended and say, I am not. And yet that's a biblical term. And the Bible says by definition that that is nakedness. Now let's give some more definition of nakedness. If you don't get another point, get this point. Exposing the thigh is exposing one's nakedness. And let's see if we can find the evidence of that. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 3. That's where we started. When they were completely nude, they exposed the thigh, but much more than that, they were said to be naked. We all got that. Now, after they covered the midsection of the body, the thigh, and more showing, they were still said to be naked. It wasn't until we got to verse 21 that God covered from the shoulder to the knee, covering completely the thigh, that their nakedness was covered. Let us set that as the tone before we go to Exodus 28. Let's go to Exodus 28. You may have some marginal notes from a previous study, and if you don't, this may be a good occasion to make some marginal notes here at Exodus 28. In Exodus 28, speaking of the garment of the priest, and you say, we're not under the Old Testament. I know that. This is not a law that is binding us to wear the garments that the priest wore, but it does give us a definition just like obedience, for example, the word obey. We talk about obedience and we find a passage in the Old Testament where obedience is defined as doing what God says do. I'm not under the same law, but the definitions are the same. So here notice what he says at verse 42. You shall make linen trousers to cover their nakedness. There's our word. They shall reach from the waist to the thighs. That Hebrew idiom that includes, that is, that talks about from and to, was used with reference to cities, from this city to that city, or this region to that region. I can give a number of examples of that in Genesis 10, Genesis 11, Exodus 11, Exodus 12, Numbers 4, etc. That included the things mentioned. That was the nature of that Hebrew idiom. So it is not saying it goes from the waist up unto the thigh, and their nakedness is covered, but it covers from the waist including the thigh, and that covered their nakedness. See the point? The point is, exposing the thigh is exposing one's nakedness. Now let's notice another example where that's the case. These three passages are harmonizing. There is no disarray between them. Let's go to the book of Isaiah, chapter 47. Now this is in a symbolic sense, but the point is still the same. And this is what God's going to do to Babylon. What God is saying is, I'm going to embarrass Babylon. I'm going to embarrass her. How are you going to embarrass Babylon? He said, take off the skirt, uncover the thigh. Pass through the rivers, your nakedness shall be uncovered. I'm going to humiliate Babylon. How are you going to humiliate her? I'm going to raise her skirt and show her thigh to everybody. I learned two things from that. I learned that that harmonizes with Exodus 28 and Genesis 3, that the thigh was equated with nakedness. So I'm going to show her nakedness by showing her thigh. But when you raise your skirt and expose your thigh, you should be humiliated by that. Because God said, that's what I'm going to do. When I humiliate a nation, I'm going to lift her skirt and show her thigh to everybody. And you contrast that to the modern day Christian woman who raises the skirt, shows her thigh, and she's not humiliated at all. Think about the difference. But here's the conclusion. When one sees your thigh, they see your nakedness. Now, that's true. If this principle be true right here, these passages, as we saw, nakedness is equated with the thigh by Bible definition. When one sees your thigh, they're seeing your nakedness. Now, that might be in the form of a bathing suit. You go out in public in your shorts and your thighs showing. The short dress. Or maybe the dress that's long enough that rides above the knee so that when you sit down, half of your thigh is showing, you're showing your nakedness. The splits, they give a peak of the thigh, you're showing your nakedness. The holes in the jeans that you say, well, you've got these holes in the jeans and you're showing your thigh through there. You can see right through the hole and see the thigh. You're showing your nakedness. If that's not true, why is that not true? That's the question. If that's not true, why is that not true? Why would I want to show my nakedness? Here's the third principle. These are principles that govern dress. Number three, men are more visually stimulated than women. Compared to women, men are more aroused by visual stimuli. That's why porn is a more greater temptation for men. Are women given to porn? Many are, but not to the great degree that men are. Jesus acknowledged that when he talked about a man that looks upon a woman to lust after her, Matthew 5, in verse 28. He could easily look and he could lust. He warned in Proverbs 6 and in verse 25 that do not let her allure you with her eyelids, nor lust after her beauty in your heart. Her beauty could cause you to easily have a temptation to lust. The point is, men are more visually stimulated than women, and far more quickly than women. As one writer suggested, the one would like a crock pot and the other's like a microwave. Ladies, listen to this carefully. It doesn't take much visually to arouse a man's sexual interest in you. Even a hint, a glimpse, or a peek would do that. It doesn't take much. Now you say, well, we're talking about dirty-minded men. Well, you might take a look at 2 Peter 2 and in verse 14. There are such a thing as men with dirty minds. These are men who have eyes full of adultery. What does that mean? Here's a man who can't look on a woman without thinking sexual thoughts. It doesn't matter what she is, what she looks like. That he thinks in sexual terms all of the time. There are dirty-minded men. But that's not the man we're concerned about. Not all men have dirty minds, and yet at times they can be tempted. As a matter of fact, there are good, godly men who try their best to be pure, that when they see sexually attractive dress, they have to fight sexual thoughts. And that might include some in your family. Now, for a woman to dress in a sexually attractive way and then point all the blame on the man for having sexual thoughts is like leaving wires exposed and then blame the child for getting shot. Who would think of such? Well, he shouldn't have gone over there and touched those wires. Well, didn't you leave them there for him? Well, he should have left them alone. I told him to leave them alone. You bear some responsibility in that. I'm going to say more about that here in just a second. Let's talk about the word modest. We haven't even got to that word yet. Let's talk about the word modest. 1 Timothy 2 and in verse 10 says that women are to dress in modest apparel. The apparel is to be modest. Let's talk about what that word means. The American Heritage Dictionary says, and I won't read every word of every one of these definitions, I want to get the gist before us, that it has to do with a sense of moderation, having a shy or retiring nature, reserved in behavior and in dress, etc., not extreme. Can be used with reference to a charge. You might say concerning this restaurant, they have a modest charge. It means it's not an exorbitant price. It's quite reserved. Put that in the back of your mind. We're coming back to that. Vine says that the word that is translated modest means orderly, well-arranged, and decent. Well-ordering not of dress and demeanor only, but of inner life. Uttering indeed and expressing itself in outward conversation. So it means well-ordered. Furthermore, Strong says it means orderly or decorous. It's from the word cosmos. Recognize that word? Same word for world. Same word for world. It means well-arranged, respectable, honorable, modest, respectable. Let's get a summary of what that's all about. What is the word modest about? It has to do with a sense of reservation, a sense of humility, respectable, decent, and orderly. Would you describe a woman in a bathing suit parading around in the pool in front of other men? Would you say, oh, she's so reserved. I just tell you what, she's just so modest. Oh, I just admire her sense of humility and respectableness. Did you meet her over here? She's the one in that little tiny bathing suit there. Would you describe her that way? Let's put a little more clothes on her and let's now have her parading around in a miniskirt. And would you say, you know what? She's so reserved. She's so respectable and decent. And she's trying to show a sense of order about her life. Would you describe her that way? Let's put a little more clothes on her and let's make them form-fitting and tight, where it looks like she was poured into the dress, and you say, oh, she is so respectable. I just tell you what, now she's got such a sense of reservation about her, you can tell by looking. Would you describe her that way? Let's talk about the word shame. 1 Timothy 2 and in verse 9, describing the apparel, it is to be with shamefacedness. What does that word mean? It's an interesting word. This word is translated shamefacedness, shamefastness, and propriety. Some of the major translations. What does the word mean? It means a shamefastness that is fast or rooted in your character. It's not a veneer of shame where, you know, I'm really not ashamed for people to see me, but unclothed, but because I'm in the presence of others, then I will act like I have shame. That's not shame that is fast rooted in your character. This is a sense of shame that's part of your character. But it comes from a compound word which literally means, according to Strong, downcast eyes or bashfulness. Would you describe that person who is displaying their body, their thighs, for example? You know, they're so bashful. They're just so bashful. When you walk in and talk to them, they just downcast eyes. They're downcast because they're bashful. There's a sense of shame. Here's another word, good judgment. 1 Timothy 2 and in verse 10 or 9, that is to be with sobriety. What does the word sobriety suggest? Well, it means moderation, New King James says. Sobriety, King James. The word means self-governing, sound judgment. Strong says it means soundness of mind, sanity, or self-control. In other words, good judgment. Good judgment says, don't show him what he doesn't need to see. Don't show him the form of your body. Don't show him your thighs. Don't give him a peek or a glimpse of what you have. That's good judgment. That's good judgment. Now let's list some ways in which one might be immodest or sexually attractive in their dress. It's possible, in light of those terms, that a person could have a garment that's just too short. And he becomes sexually attractive. It's possible it could be too tight. It may not be short. It may go almost to the ground. And cover not only from the shoulder to the knees, it covers from the shoulder to the ankles, but it could be tight and form-fitting. What's the problem with that? Do you remember these passages, 1 Timothy 2 and 1 Peter 3, that talks about fine apparel and costly clothing? The point of those is not so much the price of the clothing. In other words, let me just back up and I'll read that quote to you when I'm ready. But suppose here a woman has a dress on that she paid $1,000 for, and another lady has a dress on she paid $10 for. The condemnation of the passage is not costly, the $1,000 dress versus the $10 dress. That's not the point. Because if the lady could afford $1,000 and she's not being gaudy and displaying her wealth, there's nothing wrong with that. That's not the point. The point of it, the costly clothing was usually thin and draped over the shape and the form of the body. Cynthia said this, who lived in the time of Christ. I see clothes of silk, if clothes they can be called, affording protection neither to the body nor the modesty of the wearer, and which are purchased for enormous sums from unknown people. See, the expensive clothing of the day was clothing made of silk that draped over the shape and the form of the body. It wasn't the price so much, it was the modesty question. Clement of Alexandria said, for luxurious clothing, which can neither conceal the shape of the body, takes its form more easily and adhering to, as it were, the flesh, receiving its shape and marks out the woman's figure so the whole body is visible. Ever see any outfits like that, that mark out the shape and the form of the body? That was the expensive clothing of the day. It's possible to have clothing too thin. It's possible to have clothing that's too low, and it's possible to have clothing that's too loose. So as you stand above her, or she stoops, you begin to see into the garment. More about that in a second. Do the principles apply when we are playing sports? My question is, if not, why not? Does modesty apply when we play sports? Now, why is it that people would come out and acknowledge this lesson and go to the elders and say, you know, I appreciate y'all having this material all the time, and we really appreciate that. But when their children on a sports team, the principles of modesty go out the window. While we're playing basketball, it doesn't apply. When we're running track, it doesn't apply. When we're swimming, it doesn't apply. When we're playing tennis, those principles don't apply. My question is, if not, why not? And listen to this very carefully. Why is it that that principle goes out the window when it comes to a wedding? Where a woman would not come to the worship assembly with a dress that can barely cover her top and see through, but she'll do that at a wedding, and that's acceptable because that's just the way you dress at a wedding. Why do the principles not apply to wedding? If not, why not? And why does it not apply to yard work? That when I'm working in the yard, I can pull all my clothes off, but I wouldn't do that in the worship assembly. I wouldn't do that out in public, but I do it in the yard where everybody else sees. If not, why not? Let's put some clothes to the test. What we've seen in the principles is we have clothing that's modest and clothing that's immodest. That is, here's this woman picking out a garment. She's trying to decide, is it modest or not? Well, modest has to do with a sense of shame, good judgment, godliness, being careful toward others. Immodest is no shame, poor judgment. We don't really truly fear God in that, and we may cause lust by what we wear. Where would you put the swimsuit? Which category would you toss it in? Where would you put cheerleading outfits? Where would you put the short dresses that expose the thigh? Dresses with splits on them. Where would you put the tight form-fitting outfits that mark out the shape and the form of the body? Where would you put that? If this were a class and you were filling out a form and turn it into the teacher, what would you do? Would you say, well, I'd take these tight form-fitting and I'd put them over here with modest. That's very modest clothing. What about sundresses? What about low-cut blouses and dresses? What about the shorts that are not the real short shorts, but they reveal the thigh and show the nakedness? Would you put it in modest or immodest? What about the jogging shorts? What about the leggings and the tights that are worn instead of pants at times? I'm like one of the elders said in the past meeting I was just in. He said, there's nothing wrong with leggings as long as it's covered. And he told some of the members, there's nothing wrong with undergarments as long as it's covered. I'm not condemning leggings and condemning the exposing that in front of others. Good point. Where would you put the strapless dresses? Where would you put the swimming trunks with no shirt? Where would you put the see-through styles? Majorette uniforms and on we could go. That's not hard to figure that out. We don't have a lot of problem here with short shorts. We may have some. Or men without shirts or bathing suits. But I want to tell you, we do have some problems with the following. Tight clothing that marks out and shows the form of the body. We do have some problems sometimes with low-cut outfits that are low-cut in the back. We do have some problems with low cut that shows cleavage. You don't need to be showing that to someone other than your mate. With see-through garments where you can see the undergarments. That's loose enough that as the men pass the Lord's Supper, they have to look another way because they can see down the garment. Or as you stoop or bend, they have to turn away. Or short dresses that are short enough, maybe not extremely short. They're not mini skirts. They're not mini dresses. But they show the thigh, and the thigh is being exposed and seen. Sundresses that are the same as the low cut and where the midriff shows out in public. Maybe not in worship, but out in public. Where the short top plays peekaboo with the midsection of the body as you begin to move about. Now, secondly. I want to suggest to you that it is altogether possible that your clothes could be sexually attractive. I want to clarify sexually attractive. Let's define the word attract. It comes from a Latin word, compound, ad and trahere. Add meaning in the direction of, and trahere means to pull. Many of you have tractors. And we get our word tractor and traction from this same word. It means to draw or pull toward. That's why you call that a tractor. It pulls toward. By definition, it pulls toward. So that's what the word attract means. Attractive means providing pleasure, arousing interest, having the ability to draw or pull. So sexually attractive clothing, it's a carefully crafted title, is clothing that draws or pulls attention towards one's body. Sexual attention to your body. I'm not talking about clothing that may draw attention because this is a unique color that you have on. And everybody's looking at the color that you have, and it's kind of a unique color, and everybody wants to know exactly where did you get that. But it draws sexual attention to your body. It draws attention to sections of your body that are sexually arousing. I said we'd be blunt. Our clothing at times can send a signal that is at times sexual. That's true whether we realize that or not. You say, well, I didn't realize I was sending the signal. Well, that doesn't mean you're not sending the signal. And that's going to be true whether you intend that or not. You say, well, I didn't intend to send a sexual signal by this outfit. But you know, this woman in the bathing suit, she said, you know, I'm just out here sunning and getting a tan and just trying to swim, and I'm not trying to do anything to draw attention to myself. It's going to be true whether that's your intent or not. As far as men are concerned, ladies, listen carefully. Sexually attractive clothing has the same effect whether you intend it or not. You may be sending signals that you're not aware that you're sending. That's altogether possible. I won't give you lengthy quotations, but I wanted to share this quote with you. You've seen this before. Some of you have anyway. This is a book called The Male Factor from Shantai Feldhahn. This is not a New Testament Christian. This is not a preacher's or a preacher's wife. This is not your old fogey grandmother that's out of date and doesn't know what style is. This is a businesswoman who is writing from the vantage point that many women in the business world are dressing in a sexually attractive way, and they do not realize that is a distraction to them, and they didn't know what men were thinking when they look at them. That's what her point is. And I won't share all the quotations. She said, among the thousands of men and women I've interviewed and surveyed over the years, I've found no subject more universally misunderstood than what a man thinks when he sees a woman showing overtly showing a good figure. And she goes on to say that here was the difference in the two. And I won't read the entire quotation here, but I'll summarize it for you. That when a woman would come into a business setting with a tight skirt or a low-cut top, she asked the men what were they thinking, and she asked the women who dressed that way what they were thinking, and they had entirely different thoughts. Most of the men thought she's trying to be attractive. And we have a hard time focusing on what she's saying in this business setting because we're looking at her figure. Where 75% of the women, I believe it's 76% of the women said, we weren't thinking that at all. We weren't trying to send a signal. Had no clue the signal was being sent. Point made. It is worth our time, and I realize our time is quickly getting by, but it's worth our time to talk about the testimony from a prostitute. Let's go back to Proverbs 7 and verse 10. I said we'd come back to that. Proverbs 7 talks about the attire of a harlot. That says a great deal. The attire of a harlot says she knows how to dress so as to be sexually attractive. She has something to sell, by the way. And she wants to make that attractive to her clients. Now, you may have the idea that when you think about a harlot or a prostitute, that you're thinking of some trashy, painted-up gal who walks the streets that looks like she has a gallon of makeup on her face, and she just looks trashy, not attractive to anybody. That's not the picture here. That's not the picture at all. She's wearing clothing that pulls sexual attention. And I want to tell you a story. A fellow gospel preacher, some of you have heard his lesson where he tells the story. And perhaps you've heard him tell this in person. Gary Henry, who preaches lives in Kentucky now, used to live up here in Nashville, interviewed a prostitute a number of years ago. He lived in Nevada for a little while, was out there selling books. In Nevada, prostitution is legal, so a woman could very well reveal, even to the police, that I'm a prostitute and there's no problem, legally. So he sat down by this woman and he struck up a conversation. She asked, what do you do? And he said, I'm out here selling books and what do you do? And she said that she was working weekends at a brothel on commission. In other words, she's a prostitute. And so he found that quite interesting, and he asked her, well, since you are in that business, can you define something for me? Can you, you know, the Bible talks about the attire of a harlot. Can you explain that to me? And she said, well, sure I can. And she said, the attire of a harlot is how you draw attention to certain parts of your body. And she said, there are five basic ways of doing that. She said, you could reveal your body, the least effective. You could conceal it and reveal everything else, like the bikini effect. You could reveal just a little bit of it, give a hint or a preview or a glimpse. You can cover it tightly and show the form, or you can cover it thinly. And she said, that is the most provocative of all. Cover it thinly. Gary's response to her was, you seem to know a good bit about men. And she said, listen to this, it's my business to know. He said, why is it that religious women don't often know as much about men as you do? And here, listen to this, mothers. Listen to this, mothers. Because they have never been taught about men by anyone other than their mothers, who often know very little themselves. Women who know how men think are those who've been taught so by a man. She said, men taught me this. I know how men think, and I know how to be sexually attractive to them. Now, that's not a preacher of the gospel saying that. That was the harlot saying that. Now, Gary's a gospel preacher, but the harlot's not. She and your old fogey grandmother. So let's talk about what she just said, and I'll quickly go over these. She said, one of the ways to be sexually attractive is reveal it, show more skin. Perhaps the more you show, the more attractive you become. Give them a look at your thighs. That's revealing it. Give them a look at your breast, at least just part of that. Let them see your midriff. In other words, you reveal it. You show them your back. You show them your shoulders. So you be revealing. That's one way of doing that. That's not the greatest way to do that if you want to be sexually attractive, but that's one way. The second way, she said, was you conceal it and reveal everything else, like the bikini draws attention to what remains covered. The third way, she said, of doing that was you reveal just a little bit of it. You give them a glimpse of the thigh. Don't wear the short shorts that give them the whole picture of the thigh, but just give them a glimpse of the thigh, the dress or the skirt that's not real short but gives them a hint of the thigh. She said that's very provocative. Wear the jeans that play peekaboo with the low back. Give them a peek, give them a glimpse. Let them see some cleavage, just a preview. Don't show them everything, just give them a preview. The fourth way, she said, is cover it tightly, like the one-piece bathing suits or the tight jeans or the tight pants. Or tops that reveal the shape of the breast, or maybe a snug fit dress or a skirt over the backside. That's covering it tightly. That was what a harlot said. She said, that works. That draws sexual attention. Or maybe it's so tight the lines of the undergarment clearly are marked out. But the most provocative of all is covering it thinly. Maybe like the white or thin tops where that reveals the undergarments underneath. Or thin pants that, again, mark out the undergarments. Or material so thin it clings to the body or you can see through it. She said that works very effectively. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is objections. You know what the biggest objection to this material usually is? I don't ever hear it. I don't ever hear it, but some of you hear it when the lesson is through. And you'll hear it today. When we're through, you're going to hear this. Somebody's going to say this. They won't come to me. Probably won't go to one of the elders, but you know what they're going to say? I or we just don't agree with that. I just don't agree with that. Did you know that the denominationalists say on baptism, they say, I just don't agree with that. And if your friend said that to you, what would you say? Oh, well, then you don't have to be baptized then. It don't apply to you. You'd say, no, you owe some response to it. Honesty means that you owe some responsibility to give a better defense than that. If you say, I just don't agree with that, why do you not agree with that? Was Isaiah 47 misapplied? Was Exodus 30 or 28 misapplied? Is Genesis 3 all wrong? Does 1 Timothy 2 not apply to us? Where is the principle wrong? Is showing the thigh not nakedness? That's the largest, the biggest objection that'll be made today. Just don't agree with that. You can say that to me, and you can say that to somebody else, but try that on with the Lord and see how that works. If you say to your children, well, we just don't agree with that. Mom and Dad just don't agree with that. And y'all go ahead and dress like you want. And so we just don't agree with that. You owe it to your children to explain why and get your Bible open and say, Brother Rader was wrong today because he went too far. And here's where this is where it is. Listen to me carefully, fathers. Here's what we need in this church. We need husbands and fathers to become leaders and have the courage to take a stand on this issue in your families. We need that. We can take a stand in the pulpit. The elders can talk to your families. The elders can talk to your children. We need fathers to look at their daughters and say, you're not going to wear that. We need husbands to look at their wives and say, that is provocative. I do not want men seeing that. When you go out in public, take clothes off and put on something else. We have men, and I don't mean to be rude, but we have some husbands and fathers who lack spine to stand up on this issue. Now, what are the objections? Someone says, you know what? If somebody thinks something, that's just their problem. I'll dress this way if I want to. And if a man looks at me and he lusts, then that's his problem. Well, that problem is secondary, but the main problem is that parts of your body that he should not see should not be shown. Be it your thighs, your form, and your cleavage. That's a big question. One who causes another to stumble and initiates the process bears some guilt. Evidence of that is in Luke 17. If you can cause your brother to sin, remember that. Remember Jezebel stirred up her husband to sin? 1 Kings chapter 21, verse 25, Ahab. Here's one of the biggest objections, probably second to the one that we started with a moment ago, that I just don't agree with, that is, we can't know where to draw the line. We just don't know where to draw the line. Well, certainly there are areas of judgment. There may be an outfit that you, this is a judgment call. I recognize that. But to say we don't know where to draw the line puts us in a real strange position. Because what that means is we can start letting the dress get shorter and shorter and shorter, and you tell me where to stop. Let's start at the knee. We all agree that that's okay. And let's take an inch off. We okay? Now remember, you said we don't know where to draw the line, so let's take it to 2 inches and then 3 inches. And you tell me in your mind where to stop. 4 inches, 5 inches, 6 inches, 7, 8, 9, 10. We're getting pretty short. 12, 15 inches, there ain't much dress left, if any at all. Now remember, we don't know where to draw the line. Let's let the top get shorter. We don't know where to draw the line. And so from the shoulder, let's start there. And let's go an inch, 2 inches, 3 inches, 4 inches, 5 inches, 6 inches, 10, 12, 15. There's not much top left. Remember, we don't know where to draw the line. Remember that? And anywhere when you say, stop, we can't go any further. We can't let that dress go any shorter. That's arbitrary by your definition. It's arbitrary. Because you say, we don't know where to draw the line, but when it got 6 inches above the knee or 7 inches above the knee, you say, stop, we can't go any further. That's arbitrary. That's just you made up that line. Because we don't know, because God didn't give us any line. Remember that was the argument. God did give us something to draw the line. Remember from the shoulder to the knee, the tunic? That's a pretty good guideline, isn't it? And the thighs being a part of the nakedness, I'm not to show that. That's a pretty good guideline. And anything that is sexually attractive, it draws attention to the body, sexual attention. And here's the last. That it's really, really, really hard to find modest clothes. There'll be people who say, you know what, I agree with everything you say, and I appreciate you elders standing on that, but I want to tell you what, it's really hard to find modest clothes. Hard? Yes, but not impossible. Do you think all these ladies in this church can't find, that nobody can find modest clothes? What do you think everybody else is doing? If they couldn't be found, then what you're saying is, I can't conform to God's will. God tells me to be modest, but you just can't find them. I've been to the store and I can't find them, so I just got to dress this way. How absurd. The way of the Lord is not always easy. The Lord told us that. It's difficult, Matthew 7. Some of you have seen this illustration before, but I think it captures the point. Let's just suppose this, for argument's sake, that the Bible teaches us, I know it doesn't, but let's just say for argument's sake, that to be identified with the people of God, we all have to wear, in public, anytime we're out in public, orange coveralls. I know the Bible doesn't teach it, but let's just argue that for argument's sake. Suppose we could show from the Scriptures that if you want to be identified with God's people, we all, everyone, man and women, Man and woman has to wear orange coveralls. My question is, what would you do? What would you do? Would you say, I'd rather just look like the world. Those look dorky. Y'all use that word these days. Well, they do look dorky, whatever that word means. Would you think it was worth the sacrifice? Is it worth the ridicule for people to make fun of you? Well, you look pitiful in those orange coveralls. Would you make sure yours were orange? Would you say, you know what, I've looked for orange coveralls and I can't find them. So that's why I wear blue jeans. Remember, the Bible says we have to wear orange coveralls. Would you think of some solution, maybe? Do you think maybe we could buy some white coveralls at the painter's store and dye them orange? Would that be a solution? I believe we could do that. Are there not some women around here, somebody like Karen, that you could say, could you make us some orange coveralls? She's a seamstress. And I want to tell you, I can't sew, but I believe I could learn to sew. If that was the only way to meet the will of God, I'd get me a sewing machine and I'd figure out how to make orange coveralls for myself. I believe I could do that. If I couldn't, Stephen would show me how. Couldn't we do that? What have we seen? I realize we've taken time. Not quite an hour, we're not there yet. But here's the conclusion we have. The principle applies to men as well as it does women. We saw that in Genesis 3. It applies when we stand, when we sit, when we bend, and when we lean. You stand in front of the mirror and you say, I look good. I think I'm modest. And then you go sit down and you may not be. And when you lean and when you stoop and when you sit, the principle applies. It applies to more than the length of clothing, the tight, the form-fitting, and the see-through clothing. Could you say that one is trying to be modest and not be sexually attractive when, if an additional half inch of skin were shown, their nakedness would be exposed? They try to get so close. And she's constantly tugging at her skirt to make sure, I've almost got it there, and if I stretch just a little more, I think I've got everything covered. Did you say she's not trying to be sexually attractive? Could you say one's not trying to be sexually attractive when, if they move or bend or stoop, they show their nakedness, and if it was just a quarter of an inch tighter, it would clearly mark out her form? I ask you to give it a fair hearing. That's all I ask. Give it a fair hearing. Weigh it out. Think about it. See how it applies to your life. Fathers, take a look at your families. Have courage. Have backbone. Have leadership in the family, in the home. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins and acknowledge your faith and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?